the study had left off in Revelation 13, and we were finishing up on this mark of the beast, and then we were going to look into this sub study of the mark. And if you have that email we sent out dated May 10th, that's pretty much an outline that we're just going to use for convenience sake. If you don't have it, it's okay. There's no special information there. It's just, like I say, an outline. So, Sister Carrie, could you read for us Revelation 13? And even though we're picking up a 17 and 18, please read 15 through 18.
Okay, Revelations 13, 15 through 18. And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And he causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, and that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666.
Okay, very good. Any opening comments on that, Sister Carrie?
Just a quick pass would be that the combination of the church powers that are combined by the Catholic or the papacy, the papal system, the Protestant systems, combine together to they may request that people conform to something such as a number, and those who subscribe to this those who don't subscribe to it, it's easier to say, is they would be killed, persecuted, and killed, and everyone will be required, and they won't be able to carry on their own business without it. And then there's some indications in the last verse 18 of this number, and there's some Latin phrase that I don't remember where that was, but it does use Latin numerals. If you add up the phrase with the Latin numerals, it adds up to 666. I don't know if we got into that last week or if I read that somewhere else. Sorry. Over.
Well, that's very good, Sister Carrie. That's a good summation. And, it's in a variety of places. It was on that May 10th email included. So that might be a place where one might have seen that, but it's pretty readily known amongst the brethren. So that's a good thing. Sister Alice.
I have that, the Roman, it's in three languages on the cross, Latin, Hebrew, and Greek. And each of these languages total 666. And under the Latin, Vicar of the Son of God, or Vicar Ives Filii Del, is written on the Pope's crown and over the entrance to the Vatican. And each of these letters given a number, the total is 666. For Hebrew, the name Romus is the name for Rome, and the Hebrew alphabet is used, and it comes to 666. For the Greek, Latinos, L-A-T-E-I-N-O-S, that the Western Church of Rome was called Latins, and in Latin, it's Latinos, Latin man. the numbers come up to 666. And in Chaldean, Rome, the name of Rome was Saturnia. And in the Chaldea is pronounced Satur with only four letters and a total 666. Over.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Sister Alice. Sister Bessie, you did have your hand up earlier. Did you have a comment?
Yes, I have that. I would like to say also that the beast is very important to see was wounded by the sword and yet lived, which the sword means, I remember Sister Ruth said that the sword is the word of God and shows that the Protestant bring this wound by the sword. So the truth was the sword. Thank you.
Yes, that is in the same chapter, and it's in verse 14 that this beast, the papal beast, was wounded by a sword and did live. And the sword of truth suggested is the truth of the Reformation from the Word of God. And yet with the Counter-Reformation, the papacy healed this wound and survived. So, okay, very good. Well, we got started here, with verse 18. We'll go ahead and we'll just do that since we already got this far along in our discussion with the numbering, which is very good. Good comments. The number of the beast. Now, this is our ten-horned papal beast, and it's the number of a man. So if you think of papacy in scripture, if you think of papacy and the expression man, what verses might come to mind? In our New Testament, we've got papacy. We're thinking of the papacy, but we have the word man. What might we think of? Sister Marilee.
2 Thessalonians, when it speaks of the man of sin.
Okay, very good. That's what I was thinking of, and there might be others, but let's take a read there. That's good. So 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter. And Marilee, could you read there for us 3 and 4, please?
Let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come except there come a falling away first, and that man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition, who opposeth and exalteth himself above all that is called God, or that is worshipped, so that he as God, sitting in the temple of God, showeth himself that he is God.
All right. Further comments on this, Sister Marilee?
Well, personally, I feel that it pegs papacy in the representation of the Pope, because exactly that's what the Pope claims or is claimed of the Pope, not only by the hierarchy, but also by the parishioners. They actually believe that he is the vicar of God and that what he claims is directly from God to the people. So that's why there's such a great throng of Catholicism that's engulfed the world. One is the fear of eternal torment, but that's also in Protestantism. But here you have a representative of God actually here in human form. And that is just, quote, scripturally wonderful.
Okay, very good. As some might say, that's pretty heady stuff.
Yeah.
Of God's representative in flesh. Now, thank you, Sister Marilee. And so we appreciate that we have a double connection link in this verse back to what we're considering. We have this man of sin, and we have that he presents himself as if he was God. And it's not a literal temple, but it's presented as it were, the spiritual temple, and the church. This is how he presents himself. So our title, Vicar of the Son of God, if you were to take that title and put it in Latin, that's, as brought out earlier, Vicarius Filii Dei. Three words. The Dei, D-E-I, is God. The Vicar of the Son of God, Vicarius Filii Dei. And that's where the brethren over the years have taken those Latin letters of Vicarius Filii Dei and gave them their the Latin numerical counterpart. And some of the letters do not have a numerical counterpart, so they are just a zero, or they're not included. And in that May 10th, we've put that out there. Does anyone need to have that expressed for their notes? We'll take the time to express it now if anyone needs that. Otherwise, we'll assume you have it. Okay, very good. Now, the number of the man, this 666, it's not a single man, as brought out in the comments. It's the line of popes. So all the successor, pope successors, they all have this same, supposed title and authority. So this helps us identify that, this is the man of the number we're supposed to be looking for. But are there any other verses that came to mind when we asked, is there anything related to this number of a man that would make a connection to the papacy? Okay. So all I'm going to point out, not that it's, you know, because we'll go back to the Revelation. It's in the 12th chapter. And, in Revelation 12, let's just read there. This will come back to mind for most of us here. Brother David Vickery, could you read Revelation 12 and verse 4 and 5, please?
Revelation 12, verse 4 and 5. And his tail drew the third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne.
Brief connection there, Brother David?
Just the idea that it kind of calls out the birth of this little horn. The way it was actually came about into the world from the Roman development, and that it actually cast down the stars of heaven, and that this new child was caught up unto a position of God and to his throne, which talks about the seating or his eventual seating in this position, which he assumed and claimed himself, and I'll leave it at that, Brother Rick.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you. Sister Carrie.
In verse 5, it says, and she brought forth a man-child, and that is the man of sin. Over.
Very good. So this is the development of a man-child who would then become the man of sin. This is in its infancy, if you will, in 325 A.D., more or less, and then future into 539. And that develops us into our verse 7, Revelation 12, 7. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels. And we've studied this, as you know, and this was a counterfeit Michael. This was the papacy. This was a line of popes. But what does the name Michael mean? Michael, what does that mean? Brother Dan.
Who as God?
Exactly. So it fits right in with our 2 Thessalonians 2. Fits right in with the development of this man-child growing and developing when the papacy gained more power over the empire, Roman Empire, that then this is a number of a man we're looking for, who presents himself as if he was God, God's representative, the vicar of Christ. So I think these three sets of verses do help us with our interpretation. Not that anyone was questioning it, but it does give us a little more support to understand our Revelation 13, that verse 18, about the scriptural clue that's the number of a man. Other comments on that angle? Brother Adi.
I mean, I didn't have a comment on that angle, but I had a comment on verse 18.
Okay.
It's that the number of the beast has to be calculated. It actually says to calculate the number. It's not going to be an outright number of 666. So if someone says, oh, there's Charles Manson, for example, he had 666 on his forehead. That's he's not the beast. He's not the man of sin, even though he is a bad guy. So this number has to be calculated mathematically. Over.
Okay, very good. And that's very helpful. Thank you, Brother Adi, because so many well-intentioned Christians have been misguided into thinking that this is going to be like a literal tattoo or stamp of 666 on a hand or forehead. And they miss the mark. But so this, Brother Adi's comment helps us understand it to be calculated, what this number would represent. All right, very good. I'm going to guess Ruth.
Yeah, I was thinking also that it demonstrates the understanding you have to have of what a terrible claim this is, and that it's actually the abomination, one part of the abomination, the real abomination is the mass, but him being the vicar of Christ, he creates Christ. He has the power to create Christ in the mass, and he has the power to speak for God like a counterfeit Michael. You have to recognize what an abomination this is to the Lord so that you don't receive the mark, that the mark is going to have something to do with this. It seems like you're going to have to recognize this doctrine to withstand it, like so many of Christians had to before, like the Waldenses and the Huguenots and these different things. They recognized this abomination, and you can't just fudge it over.
Okay, very good point. And that does help us to link the beast that we're talking about in Revelation 13, 15 through 18, to the first beast in Revelation 13, the ten-horned beast, because it told us there in Revelation 13, 1, that there had on his heads the names of blasphemy, that we read in verse chapter 13 and verse 5, that was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. And in verse 13, 6, he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and so on. We don't read that about the two-horned beast. That's not the particular problem with the two-horned beast, our Church of England and Ireland, that we're introduced to in verse 11, chapter 13, verse 11. Nor is that the particular problem with the image of the beast. So this blasphemy, these title claims seem to certainly present themselves most powerfully in the papal beast. So that goes there. All right, Sister Shaw.
Well, it just made me think of, it doesn't have to do with the 666, but the Christian world looking for Antichrist being against Christ when it really has more the meaning of instead of. So it goes along with the scriptures we're reading. And if you're not clear on what to look for in that aspect, you would definitely miss the boat. Over.
Yes, very good. So not, you know, many Christians, as Sister Cheryl's bringing out, think of the Antichrist as maybe like Muslim or something else, but rather she's bringing out it's instead of Christ. They're replacing the true Christ. Very good. Brother Chris.
Yeah, along with the conversation, just the obvious point that all these, whenever approaching these subjects, if we're talking to somebody who's lending their ear, we always have to predicate it with Revelation chapter 1, verse 1, that Revelation is a book of symbols and that the angels signified this whole thing. So to take it literal, like our, as the friends are saying, they'll never get it. So they'll misunderstand it. So how many times do we hear at the fair that people, oh, we're in a Revelation study with our church. It's like, oh, you know, your heart almost sinks because, you know, they're just, it's like, oh, gee, how about, come over there and help you out a little bit. But I also wanted, while the mic is open, it's a little small point. But verse 17, and that no man might buy or sell save he that had. Now we know it's a little bit different application, but I did have a cross reference to Proverbs 23:23. And that just simply states, buy the truth and sell it not, also wisdom and instruction and understanding. So it just uses the same language. I think we understand the buying and selling is the free exchange of the truth. Not that selling is bad in this verse, I don't think. Although there might be an application to it because it's the papacy that's dictating what you can do or not do. Over.
Okay, good. Appreciate that verse. Very good. So, okay. Excuse me. We do have to go back a little bit. We jumped ahead on the numbers of the name because it was brought out, and that was good. Did anyone have anything more on the number of the name? Are we all satisfied there? Sister Carrie.
Quickly, I just want to say I remembered where I read it. It wasn't in any Bible student information. It was in a Christian theologian's book.
Okay.
The number, the Latin corresponding to the words that you just mentioned earlier that I forgot. Vicarius Filio Dei. Over.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, Protestants had this right in days gone by. It's the evangelicals who've confused it now. All right, but thank you. Sister Mary.
It's also in the seventh volume and the Revelation study.
Yes, so the supposed seventh volume, not written by Brother Russell, written after his graduation, the brethren there include, they give a verse by verse of Revelation and the book of Ezekiel. Two brothers collaborated. However, the brethren have said that there's a lot of good information that one can get from the finished mystery. But then there's some really far out stuff there too. So if you read it, you won't be overly thrown off by their errors. Are pretty obvious. Okay, thank you, Sister Debbie.
Yeah, I don't know. I had to leave for a second. You know, I wasn't, because I have dog issues. But anyway, did anyone say anything about, okay, so the number six, we know, is a man-made concoction. You know, it's an imperfect man number. It's a man-made concoction, and that the three sixes could, in my mind, could relate to the Trinity. Man-made concoction that's, deals with three things. It's just a thought. Throw it out there for whatever. Over.
Okay. Well, that was one of the things that, was brought out, was that the Greek demonstrates that's a calculation of to reach 666. So the 666 is just a verbal abbreviation. It's 666. Which goes well with how the friends have been calculating the name of this man-made number. But okay. Is there a follow-up, Sister Debbie? Okay. So then we'll go back in our verse, highlight a few points, that we talked about. Verse 15. The two-horned beast, the Church of England, had power to give life to the image of the beast. The image of the beast being the Evangelical Alliance or Protestants, that they would unite by both groups now having supposed apostolic succession. And that is what the Church of England claims to have when they broke away from the papacy, continued to have it, and that's what they're going to apparently share with the Federated Protestants. This is a future event. This hasn't happened yet. They're working toward it. It's what we call generally the ecumenical movement. And it goes on that that the image of the beast then should both speak, and as we talked about, that's where it equates to the false prophet. And that we looked at verses on that. And cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast, this vitalized image of the beast, which is now Federated Protestant groups, should be killed. And he calls all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads. The right hand was cooperation. And the forehead was that intellectually one agreed with the doctrinal position. And that no man might buy or sell save he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So we have Federated Protestants united. They are empowered in a cooperative effort with the civil authorities to set a standard of Orthodox Christianity that would include cooperating and recognizing the papacy, but it would exclude anyone who didn't agree with their standard of Orthodox belief. We discussed what the Evangelical Alliance in 1846, their 9-point doctrinal position, did include Trinity and the bodily resurrection of Jesus, including the Apostles' Creed. So, the suggestion, brethren, is this is a future event because we haven't seen this cooperative effort at this point. But we do see a tendency toward that as we see evangelical Christians cooperating with Roman Catholics on primarily social issues at this point in time. But we're looking forward to a more close relationship. And that's what Brother Russell was looking for as well. Sister Marilee or Ruth?
I just wanted to say that Brother Russell also applies vicarious Billy Day to 666 in the question book, page 37.
Okay. Very good. Question book, page 37. Thank you. So this restriction of being able to buy or sell as brought out, the primary point would be spiritual or truth, not being able to promote the truth in a public way. That's how Brother Russell understood it. And he linked this to John 9, verse 4, John 9, 4, where Jesus said, we must work the works of him while it is called day, for the night cometh when no man can work. So Brother Russell looked forward prophetically to a time when the true Christians would not be able to do Christian work of promoting the truth, because it would be a night time, a time where during the night it's dark. And so it would be a time when the light of truth would be restricted by the authorities. And so he linked these verses together and looked forward to this time of a future persecution. It's similar to when John the Baptist was imprisoned after making his announcements. It's similar to Jesus being arrested after he had been teaching publicly. So that what we find is that what we're looking forward to is a time when our efforts that we're engaging in now will be somehow restricted, and there may be a further emphasis where you could be excommunicated, spiritually killed in their mind, or there could be literal persecution. It would not surprise us for both. This has historically happened throughout the gospel age at different times. And it happened under the Nazis, and it happened under communists, where many of our brethren in the 20th century did suffer in this way. So it's not that it can't happen. It does. But we're looking for a more concerted, and not worldwide necessarily, like thinking that non-Christianized countries would get involved, but through the Christianized world, particularly this area that's known as the Roman Empire and the subsequent colonies of the Roman Empire, which would include North America, parts of South America, parts of Africa, and elsewhere. So wherever there is a so-called Christian element, it would probably include that area. Now, all that being said, are there further comments or questions on these verses here? Or we'll look at a sub-study on the mark. Anything more at this time? Okay. Brother Chris, I could see that hand almost ready to go.
These are very small points, but I just wanted to bring it out for brethren who like to drill down. And you know, if you do your Bible reading cover to cover, and you will find that in Ezra chapter 2, verse 13, Ezra is listing the families that are returning back to Israel from Babylon. And in verse 13, it says, the children of Adonikim, 606 and 6. Pretty big family. So, of course, you see the number 666, and it's like, is there any spiritual connection? And there's really nothing, except if you look up what the name Adonikam means in the Gruden's name in dictionary, it means the Lord is raised. So it's just a note that these are other places in the Bible that you might find 666. And the other thing I like to bring out, Brother Norm Pedler showed me in his World Book Encyclopedia, when you look up Pope, it's on page 666. It's just a quirk that happened, allegedly. Over.
All right. Okay. And if that wasn't enough, there's still more. Okay. Very good. Thank you. So brethren, as we start this sub study or side study, I should say, on the mark, want to emphasize that when we were reading in Revelation, the 12th chapter, we saw a progression through the 12th chapter in time. We could make a timeline And it began back in 33 AD in the first verse, because we had the woman clothed with the sun standing on the moon, the 12 stars on her head. It's showing that the early church was being developed at the beginning of the gospel age, after our Lord had ascended into glory. And it continued down to where actually the final verses of the 12th chapter bring us to a time we think is still future, a prophetic time of a future persecution on the seed of the woman. We covered that. But I'm just showing the progressiveness of the 12th chapter. Well, the 13th chapter, even though it moved forward in time, our first verse opened up with our seeing the seven-headed and ten-horned beast arising out of the sea. So we began with, again, now with papacy and its development, and how the dragon gave his seat under the woman, under the beast, sorry, and that showed how civil Rome gave way to papal Rome over time. And then we developed it to where we then are introduced in the 1500s to the two-horned beast, then into 1846 with the image of the beast. And now we think these concluding verses are pointing to a future event, once again, of this enforced marking of the beast. So someone could intellectually agree with the papacy. Someone could cooperate with the papacy, just go along with it. And that could be a marking, indeed. But the enforced marking of all, that, we believe, hasn't happened yet. And it's an enforced marking by Protestants federated endorsing the papacy. So as we brought out the two sides of the thorny scroll. So with that being said, this is the first place in the Revelation where this marking has been brought to our attention. The remaining five, there's a total of six places in the Revelation. Total of six places in the Revelation where this marking is mentioned. So all of them would be from this future point of time of an enforced marking, and it would take place thereafter. It's certainly all during the harvest period, with one reference to the victors in the future, but what they had overcome. So I just want to say that as we start to look at these verses, they're all going to be in chapters that follow this 13th chapter. Okay. Sister Connie, could you read in Revelation 14, could you read for us verse, we're going to say 9 through 11.
And another angel, a third, followed them, saying with a great voice, "If any man worship the beast in his image and receive a mark on his forehead or upon his hand, he also shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is prepared undiluted in the cup of his anger, and he shall be put to the test with fire and brimstone in the sight of the holy angels and in the sight of the Lamb. And the smoke of their trial goeth up forever and ever, and they have no rest day and night, that they that worship the beast in his image, and whoso receiveth the mark of its name."
Okay. First, Sister Connie, that was very nice that torment was translated, tested. What translation is that?
It is the Revised Version, Improved and Corrected.
Oh, okay. Very good. Thank you. So we appreciate that. That's our Bazanisos word, but without getting sidetracked, we'll continue. Sister Connie, any opening observations on these verses?
No.
Okay. Brother Dan, the mic's open. You have some opening observations on these verses for us?
Well, just to start off with, we see that here we have another place where we see that there will be an enforced marking of the beast and its image. So, and it's a future event as we understand it, and it tells us the results for those who refuse to take the mark. Let's see here. And the third angel followed. I'm sorry, I've got to reread it to think. Third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If any man worship the beast, if any man worship the beast and his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine." So this is talking about those who do take the mark, that they are going to receive the wrath of God, because of course this is the false systems of religion, the Catholic and Protestant, and those who support it either intellectually or with their works are going to be judged with these institutions, and they're going to be destroyed. So they're going to receive this judgment or punishment, if you will. Verse 11, I think, tells us that this destruction is going to be a total destruction, where they rise not up again from, you know, they will live no more, if you will, the destruction of false religion, Protestant and Catholic. Over.
Okay, well, thank you, Brother Dan, and I know we're just, I'll call you a second, Brother David. I know we're just jumping in here on this. It's not the destruction of the, everything went great, it's just that you were bringing out, just that it's not the destruction of the nominal systems here. It's the torment of the individuals that's brought out. Okay. Brother David.
Thanks, Brother Rick. This section reminds me of Revelation 17:4, which is it's basically about and the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet color and decked with gold and precious stones, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And this is the cup of God's indignation. So this reminds me of, I think what you pointed out at one time, his retributive justice for this system and how it would begin to play out. Over.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Brother David. Ruth, or Sister Marilyn.
I was wondering, verse 10, with shall be tormented with fire and brimstone. I was wondering if it connects at all with verse 18, and another angel came out from the altar which had power over fire and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle. We say that fire is the judgment, the truth that's the judgment, particularly of Babylon. So I'm wondering if they're particularly tormented and struggling with the judgment message against Babylon that they're ignoring and by staying with her. Verse 10, I just wondered if there might be a connection. Over.
Okay, thank you. There may be. We are going to go through these verses systematically when we get to them. And so the side study is a little unsatisfactory. Let me just go over these couple of verses. This is the third angel, the third message. It is a message of warning that if anyone would receive the mark of papacy or federated Protestants, whether they just cooperate with it, the mark in their hand, or whether they intellectually agree with it, the mark in the forehead, it's going to bring them torment of conscience. It is going to lead to their is going to lead to the complete destruction and annihilation of the errors and the false creed systems that they agreed to. That's going to be an example forever, smoke going up forever, that anyone who worships or cooperates with the creature, here it's the Antichrist systems, rather than the creator, the Lord God Almighty, it spells personal conflict of conscience, bitterness, anguish of soul, so that the sulfur mingled with the fire and sulfur, verse 10, shows a complete annihilation of their creeds. The individual will be come up in the times of restitution as an individual, but their creedal beliefs are going to be completely annihilated by the truth. But that is going to at first lead them to great discomfort, because everything they believed in, that they thought they were going to go to heaven for being a part of the Methodist Church or the Roman Catholic Church, it's going to be demonstrated that was all false. This is the equivalent to the burning of the bundled tares in Matthew 13. Remember the expression in Matthew 13 that the bundled tares would be cast into the fire and there would be wailing and gnashing of teeth. So the bundled tares show the nominal Christians in their denominations, in their unity. They think they're safe and correct. But when the truth exposes the error of those systems and what they were teaching, is going to bring great a conscious crisis. And they're going to be wailing and gnashing their teeth in despair because what they had believed in was demonstrated to actually be false, the doctrines of demons. So in my understanding of these verses, this is talking more about what individuals will suffer rather than what the system itself, the systems will suffer when they go down, which I think is what's being shown in this chapter 14, verses 17 through 20. So I'll offer that. And like I said, when we go through this verse by verse coming up, it might make it more clear. But now I'll just open this. Are there other comments on this so far? On these verses here? Sister Molly.
Good morning. Thank you. I was just wondering about the final part of the verse 10, he will be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb. I would think that would add to the torment being brought before that righteousness and glory. And I'm just wondering, do we think that that's truly going to be an individual experience for these ones? Or I'm just wondering how that symbolically might work out. Is it really just that idea of the conscience being burned by the experience and having the righteousness and the truth before them, and then understanding that false doctrine to be destroyed?
Okay, no, that's a very good question. And there is certainly a future application in the peaceable kingdom, when people will come to recognize the errors. But I think there is an application to the harvest period that the holy angels here, these messengers, would be the body members of Christ still in the flesh who are presenting the truth. And that Jesus is present. He's in Earth's atmosphere. So that this torment will be specifically when the seven last plagues have been poured out and the wrath of God has been forced upon them. What's the wrath of God in this setting? It's the truth that their teachings are wrong, and that cooperating with these antichrist systems, trusting in them, will be demonstrated to actually be working against God and defiling his character, making him more of a demon god. When that's exposed, this is going to lead to their torment. So I think there's a specific time yet in the future during this harvest period at the close where this will could take place. But I also concur that there will certainly be something similar like this when people come forth from the grave and find out what they had been worshiping and serving and supporting, was actually contrary to God. Certainly see that as well. But other comments? Brother Chris.
Yeah, just along with that, we've seen that, especially with the elderly at the fair and stuff, trying to give them a new approach to understanding scriptures in the Bible is really a big turnoff, because they've been believing in a system or belief their whole life. They learned it from mom and dad, and this is it. We go to church every Sunday. We don't want to mess that up at 70 years old. I mean, it takes a pretty brave, unique character like a Sister Petrina to be able to do that, and we know that's rare. Here, in this setting, that's the fire and brimstone. I mean, it is going to destroy the fact that they held on to it. That's the price. Ignoring it when they had the opportunity to actually look into it and at least soften the blow, they ignored it. And here they have to suffer with this abrupt, this is the truth, and everything you believed was a lie. Over.
Okay, very good. Very good. Thank you. Yes, so true. Sister Marilee, Ruth?
We could all probably tell experiences like this, but I had one at the fair with the lady that was working the Catholic booth. Remember the Catholic booth that was right behind us? And she came by and she wanted to give me one of her tracts, and I gave her one of ours. So we started talking. And as I was talking to her about what we believed, she started holding her heart, and then she started holding her stomach, and she was closing her eyes in nausea. And I thought to myself, this is like a picture of the torment that they're going to suffer when they find out that what we were saying was true. She was like so appalled that she just like was practically holding her ears, and because she was working at the Catholic booth, that's what she was defending. And I was trying not to hurt her, but what could I do? She was asking. So anyway, I was thinking of that in regard to this verse. Over.
All right, very good. And so there's more clues leading up to this in this 14th chapter. There's clues back in our, some of these previous verses that builds us to this point. But one thing we'll connect, you'll recall in Revelation 18, verse 4, the message goes out during the time of harvest. Come out of her, my people, lest you partake of her sins and receive of her plagues. So those who remain in the church systems after they've been rejected during this time of harvest, the light of truth is now so prevalent and readily available that any who ignore that, shut their eyes and ears to it, and choose to remain in these systems, they are rejecting what the Lord is offering them, so that then they will receive of the coming plagues. The plagues are truths exposing the errors of the nominal systems. They're worthy to receive them because they partake of the sins by continuing to support the mark in the hand or the mark in the head, these systems which so grievously present God's character to the people as a God of eternal torment. And God doesn't like that. And he's given the truth for over a century to make it clear. But if someone isn't interested to learn where the dead really are, or these things, then they are worthy, because they're responsible, because as Brother Russell brings out, we're not only responsible for what we know, we're responsible for what we could know or could have known. And that's why God, in his great wisdom, he always gives warnings and he gives messages to encourage the people during a time of trial so they might successfully pass it. But if they refuse it, then comes the predicted chastening. Fortunately, what's destroyed are the nominal systems. What's destroyed is the errors the people believed, as painful as that will be. But the result is, but then they'll be freed in order to be blessed in the peaceable kingdom with the truth. So still a happy ending in the long run. Sister Alice.
I just wondered, what's the status of the Evangelical Alliance today? And is there any indication of a united of the beast in the Evangelical Alliance that we see today?
Okay, that's a good question. We did cover that a few weeks back. I'll just suggest that if you want to, or anyone wants to spend the time, the Evangelical Alliance still has an active website. You can go and visit it, and they'll tell you all the different denominations that are members, and they'll give you their 9-point doctrinal belief. And we looked at that in a class a little while ago. And all we can say, Sister Alice, as an update, is we continue to see different denominations working to try to restore some connections and ties. As far as apostolic succession, the Lutheran Church is actively working with the Church of England, and there's a few others. If you look up supposed apostolic succession, you can find a list of churches which actually have that in their clergy currently. But we're watching and we're waiting for more development on that. Brother Mark.
Well, for what it's worth, I tried to trace that question many years ago. How did that go, the Evangelical Alliance? And I believe I remember it developed into the World Council of Churches in 1948, and it's been working under that since. And I haven't read much about it lately, but that's kind of why I bought my world books, to look up Protestantism when we found that Pope thing. It was kind of amusing, but so for whatever that's worth, you might want to look under World Council of Churches and see what their goals have been and how they've been developing that in the last decades over.
All right, very good. So yes, the World Council of Churches is very prominent. The Evangelical Alliance, it still exists, But that's true. We see these various efforts of the ecumenical arrangement in order to try to cooperate. You know, I'm certainly not the first brother or sister to say this, but it's a great embarrassment in the nominal Christian world that they're so divided now. You know, it long past is the protesting against the Roman Catholic Church. Now it's more trying to find a way that they can work around their doctrinal differences, their clergy arrangement differences, to where the Pope can be first among equals, is a stated goal. First among equals, which of course doesn't make sense, but That's kind of the thinking. So that's why the scriptures point out there will always be the two parts, Protestants and Roman Catholic, but they cooperate. All right. Sister Mary.
What did you unmute?
Yes. Oh, okay. As
Oh, an example of the Evangelical Alliance still having some power over some of the groupings. When New Brunswick had a public meeting down on the shore, and I have the information, but it's in either one of my second or third volumes, they rejected us having anything else to do with them, and they handed us the Evangelical Alliance points of disagreement. So at least at that time, I'm not sure if that was in the late 80s or the 90s, it was still formidable in some of the church's concepts.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Appreciate that. Sister Carrie.
Although I've been away a long time, when I was involved attending the Lutheran churches and involved some ways, it's similar in the civil government where there are the official laws on the books, and then there's the local government will interpret them and loosen them or tighten them as they see they'd like to do. But in the Lutheran church, there might be official stances, but by the time it reaches the level of the local congregation and those ministers, it is loosely interpreted sometimes. And then, so they have things called the shared pulpit and the shared altar, I think. I can't remember the terms, but you can invite ministers from other denominations to preach or serve the sacrament. And there'll be some discussion whether so-and-so is in close enough aligned, whether they should be allowed or not. And then they might say, well, the overall government says they are, they aren't. But then they'll do what they like sometimes. So we may look to the official stance and some there. Yes, we'd look to the official stance of the Evangelical Alliance, but be aware too that on the individual local levels, it happens even faster, I think, and it's not announced. It's not really easy to gauge. And at the same time, and it's been said here a lot, that a lot of the small rural congregations are not having enough ministers anymore. So they group together and share ministers, and the requirements are getting looser and looser too. So that... Yeah, it's been said. Just to keep their buildings maintained is a real issue now. So, over.
Okay, good. Thank you. And you know, one of these things, it's interesting. You have mega churches. They're like the size of a superdome. And then you've got some of the parishes that are more rural that aren't flourishing. But the real key to my mind is, where the nominal Christians are working in politics to influence who gets on school boards locally, who becomes judges at the local level, state level, who becomes judges at the federal level, all the way up to the Supreme Court, which now has a majority of Roman Catholics, and they make up what's called the conservative portion of the Supreme Court. And they got there because of political support, which you and I know means financial support, for different politicians who were willing to promote that Christian agenda. And so just in saying all that, that is more where the powerful action takes place than in the countryside parish and churches. Not that they don't have some value, but I say that because quite often brethren that have a past prophetic view point to low church attendance as if it's saying that nominal Christianity has no influence with government. And we're just pointing out, oh yes, and in quite a few countries they have a powerful influence. But now there's another little thing that came out. This was a few years ago, and the video was shared pretty predominantly amongst different brethren, even at convention. and it was a video. Someone's going to have to help me with the religious, the Protestant religious leader's name. I've been thinking of Pat Robinson and Oral Roberts, and it's not him or them.
Kenneth Copeland?
Kenneth Copeland was the Protestant leader. He had a group of pastors, evangelical-minded pastors. It was a large meeting. They panned the audience. They showed all that were there. And there was a large screen. They played a video message from Pope Francis. And Pope Francis was asking the Protestant leaders. He's personally asking. It's just like I'm talking to you right now. Pope Francis was asking the Protestant leaders, pray for him. And he was trying to encourage this ecumenical movement. And guess what? Kenneth Copeland took it to heart, and he led the whole group of Protestant evangelical pastors in prayer for the Pope. So much for protesting. So, and there were several examples of that that took place. And so I'm just saying that there's still action. We need to see there. We look for more is what I want to say. We look for more, but we've learned in the recent years how rapidly world events change, and things that once seemed impossible are suddenly happening within days. And the pandemic and everything associated with that, and this war, the ground, air, and sea war in Ukraine, in Europe, on the border of NATO allies with Russia. No one saw that. And then suddenly it's here. And so on. So things can change very rapidly. I have to say, I'm not sure how we got here in this point of our conversation from our Revelation 14, verses 9 through 11 on our side study. But let's go back to that, while our time is almost running out here. Sister Debbie?
Just real quick, I don't know if anybody knows, Pat Robertson passed away.
Yes.
So, and it was, I got the article here. It was, Kenneth Copeland and James Robeson. And then he met with Joel Osteen after that, our rich evangelist.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Let's take a look at our next one. I think we can get one more before our time expires. It's in Revelation 15. And Brother Mark, could you read in Revelation 15, verses 1 through 4, please?
All right, Revelation 15, 1 through 4. Then I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous. Seven angels who had seven plagues, which are the last, because in them the wrath of God is finished. And I saw something like a sea of glass mixed with fire, and those who had been victorious over the beast and his image and the number of his name standing on the sea of glass holding harps of God. And they sang a song of Moses, the bond servant of God, and a song of the Lamb, saying, great and marvelous are your works, O Lord God, the Almighty. Righteous and true are your words, King of the nations. Who will not fear, O Lord, and glorify your name? For you alone are holy, for all the nations will come and worship before you. For your righteous acts have been revealed. Amen to that.
Yes. Opening comments here, Brother Mark?
So seven plagues are done. Those are the last. And in them, the wrath of God, like it says, there is finished upon the beast, I would imagine, and the image of the beast and the well, we'll just leave it at that for now. And then bringing out the positive result after this, standing on the sea of glass. So I believe that's a picture of the water, calm waters, people, the people of the world will, you know, everything will be calmer then for them. And, just singing the praises of God, because that, you know, at this point, I would imagine they would understand that, hey, God was, allowing all this for him to, set up his kingdom, and, they're start praising God and going on forever the way God had finally intended mankind to be, I guess. Over.
All right, Brother Mark, thank you. You ratcheted it forward a little bit more in time, but it is a glorious outcome that we do look forward to. But we think this precedes that. The plagues are actually poured in our next chapter, chapter 16:1. But this is telling us that there are seven last plagues, which will complete the wrath of God. But in our verse 2, what we see is a condition of fire mingled with this sea of glass, but standing upon that sea of glass, or above it, as it were, supported by it, we have the victors. The victors who didn't receive this marking. And we believe this represents the final feet members of the body of Christ. And it is they who have the harps of God that can harmoniously bring forth the doctrinal support for the divine plan of the ages. And they can sing the song of Moses, the restitution of all things, and the song of the Lamb, the ransom for all, that are the basis by which then all the people will be able to come forth and worship God after these seven last plagues have done the work of destroying the nominal systems, and then individually destroying the false creeds that the nominal Christians have believed in. But the emphasis here is those who got the victory. They would not receive the mark, and the Lord sustains them through their fiery experience. Like the three Hebrews, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, they were preserved by the fourth that was there, the one like to the Son of God was with them, and so on. So for time, we have to close. Sister Marilee, you look like you had a short comment, please.
No, question. Did I hear correctly that in verse 3, it was read, "Thou King of Nations"?
Well, all nations are to worship in verse 4, but what did your translation read, Brother Mark, for the end of verse 3?
King of the Nations.
Okay.
Not the point in King James, it's the King of Saints. And they're the ones that he's speaking of, I think, as you just mentioned.
Well, that's very interesting because, Sister Marilee, in the Oxford Bible, there is a reference in the margin for that word saints, where the last word in that verse 3. And in it, the margin, it says nations or ages. Brother Mark?
Yeah, just real quick, I got a footnote there that brings you down to the one, two early manuscripts read ages, like you bring out over.
Okay, very good. Sister Debbie, what does Young say?
Young says saints, and the Strong's does say sacred, pure, morally blameless, or religiously ceremonial, consecrated, consecrated. So the Thayer's definition is most holy thing, a saint. The word is hagios. Over.
Okay, the diglot has nations. I preferred ages. Thou King of the Ages. I liked that because he is the one who's in control of the transition of the ages, but it's his divine plan. But you can't go wrong. He is certainly the King of the Saints. He's the King of the nations in due time, and he is the King of the Ages that he created in his plan, like behind Brother Chris, all those ages. And those are the Lord's. It's his creation. Marilee, we'll take your comment in lieu of a hymn.
Oh, no. Well, it's just that nations in the next verse said shall come. It doesn't seem proper to me to say nations. No matter what the definition is, I would say if we're going to use other than saints, ages would be more logical. They are always under his control, but the nations, they were not. That's why he's getting them under their control, under his control.
All right. Thank you. To be continued next week, brethren, we will, we can revisit this, and we'll continue in our sub study. We'll,